Welcome to InVision Radio, where you may not get the answers to life, but at least you'll start to enjoy the questions. Now, here's your host, Will Bowen.
Thank you very much, Dan Murphy. Well, welcome to another episode of InVision Radio. Well, I am very excited about something. I just finished editing the first pass of my new book, To You Love God, which will be coming out December 16th. It's being published by Convergent Multnomah Press. And it's a labor of love. It's something I've been working on for 7 years. I actually began doing these 7 years ago. And you may have already heard this story, but I'll tell it quickly. I was serving as a minister for church, and I noticed that when I did my talks on Sunday, everybody seemed to get excited. They felt they're recharged. And then by Wednesday or Thursday, everybody was standing outside my door wanting counseling. It was like their batteries had run down. So what I decided to do was to begin to send people an email. We had our email list from the church, and I began to send people an email as if it were coming from God, basically just saying, almost like a little small mini sermon. I was telling somebody, it's kind of like putting the mini in ministry. And started sending these out, and they started getting rather popular. And I've been doing them for 7 years, and actually 2 years ago, I asked my daughter, who was 16 at the time, my editor doesn't even know that, my daughter, who was 16, went through 7 years of these books, of these writings, and she picked what she thought were the best ones, and she was very clear as to which ones were and were not good. And then she went through and she helped put them into categories. And so we submitted them and found a wonderful publisher, and I'm very excited. The cover is going to be absolutely beautiful for this book. And it's interesting because I did these for a number of years without letting people know that I was the one doing them. I sort of kept my identity a secret. And corrections and asks me to clarify things. And so I spent the last 3 weeks doing that. And I'm really excited about them. I think that this is a book that is going to help a lot of people. It's one a day, 365 days in a year. And the idea is, of course, you read it every morning. I didn't realize this. There's a whole genre of these, of course, called Devo books, which is short for devotional. And so it's going to be out later this year. And I truly love my editor. Julia Roller is her name. She very much gets what I'm trying to do, but she holds me to the very highest of standards. All of this is a setup to say that I'm going to share one with you that is not one that we have ever shared on the internet before, either on Facebook or through email. This was one written specifically for the book, and it's very appropriate for today's show. It goes like this. To you, lack is more than not having enough of this or that. Lack is a way of living. It is a mental condition that causes people to dwell upon things that they feel are missing rather than focusing on what is present. You experience lack externally because you experience lack internally. Never enough in your mind leads to never enough in your world. Shift from lack to abundance by remembering the twin meanings of the word appreciate. To be grateful for something or someone, and to add value. When you show appreciation, what you appreciate increases in value. This day, let appreciation take you by the hand and walk with you from a world of lack into a world of abundance. Love God. This one actually came about because Julia was saying to me that she felt that I spoke about lack as if it were a place, and I had to sort of address that for myself and say that, you know what, I truly believe lack is a place. It's a place in which we live and inhabit. And if you think about it, poor health is a lack of health, lack of a lover, not having a lover is a lack of a lover, not having a job is a lack of a job, disrespect from your children is a lack of respect. Lack is a place that so many people live in, because it's what so many people notice and talk about in their lives. We all have things that we wish were a little bit more, that we feel are lacking. And yet by looking at those minor things, we actually make the major things. And pretty soon it's all we think about. And so we don't appreciate what we have. I forget who it was that first said that, and I just thought it was brilliant. I wanted to quote it, basically, and attribute it to God. How's that? But appreciate has twin meanings. Number one, to be grateful for something or someone is to appreciate them. I appreciate you. I appreciate you for listening. I appreciate my friends. I appreciate, you know, my mouse on my computer. I appreciate these things. But appreciate also means to add value. Stock appreciates. Investments appreciate. So that which we appreciate, appreciates. I know that sounds pithy, but it's very good and it's very true. What you appreciate, appreciates. What you appreciate, appreciates. What are you appreciating? Are you appreciating much? I have to say it's amazing how we people go through the day, and our economy, you have to understand, is based 100% in lack. You need this. And I say this as a person who sold advertising most of his adult life. You need this or your life is not complete. Your life is complete and you may or may not want this is the truth of it. But the idea is to make you feel lack. It's a great motivator. You know, in many ways, Western medicine has practiced from a lack idea. You're lacking in this area, and you need this to make you better, as opposed to your body can make you better. But a revolution started about 30 years ago, and it all started because of my first guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, wrote the book Love, Medicine, and Miracles, and it became an instant phenomenon. My mother was a nurse at the time, and she said that all the nurses at the hospital were reading it and talking about it. And the idea of beginning to treat people as co-creators in their restoration of health as opposed to numbers and charts and patients. This all started with Bernie Siegel, and I'll be interviewing him in just a few moments and talking about the power we have to focus on what is present in our bodies and thereby create health. Then later up, I'm going to be talking to Stowe Good. Now, who is Stowe Good? I think you'll be surprised. You may know them already. And if not, you're going to love getting to know Stowe Good. Coming up later in the program. Once again, thanks for being here. We're going to have some fun. Hang around.
What's the best vitamin for happiness? Find out on page 31. How can you overcome the biggest obstacle to happiness? That's on page 85. What's the fastest route to feeling happier? Check page 124. If you're looking for a manual for happiness, this is it. The book is Happy This Year, The Secret to Getting Happy Once and for All by Will Bowen. In this inspiring and practical book, you'll find proven real-world steps you can incorporate into your life to experience more joy in everything you do. This is the manual for happiness. In fact, the Dale Carnegie Institute of Asia selected Happy This Year as the textbook for classes on how to become a happier person. If you're serious about being happy, get Happy This Year, The Secret to Getting Happy Once and for All by Will Bowen. Available from Grand Harbor Press in hardback, ebook, and audiobook format read by the author. Your destiny is to be happy. Don't wait to be happy someday. Get happy this year.
And I said you called up a robber. Day or night, he'll be there any time at all. Dr. Robert, Dr. Robert, you're a new and better man. He helps you to understand. He does everything he can. Dr. Robert.
Welcome back to Envision Radio. I'm Will Bowen.
You can find me on the web at Facebook/WillBowen and on Twitter, it's at WRBowen. Well, I'm very excited to introduce my next guest, Dr. Bernie Siegel, who prefers to be called Bernie, holds membership in two Scholastic Honor Societies, Phi Beta Kappa and Alpha Omega Alpha. He graduated with honors. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He retired from practice as an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Yale of General and Pediatric Surgery in 1989. This is where his career, in my opinion, truly becomes remarkable, to speak to patients and their caregivers. In 1978, Bernie originated Exceptional Care Patients, ECAP, a specific form of individual and group therapy utilizing patients' drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. ECAP is based on carefrontation, a safe, loving, therapeutic confrontation which facilitates personal lifestyle changes, personal empowerment, and healing of the individual's life. In 1986, Bernie Siegel's first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, was published. The event redirected his life in 1989, Peace, Love, and Healing, and in 1993, How to Live Between Office Visits. You can find out more at Bernie Siegel, BerniesiegelMD.com. It is my great honor and thrill to welcome Bernie Siegel to Envision. Welcome, Bernie.
Thank you very much, Will.
Thank you so much for being here. I was sharing with you a bit off air. My mother chose, after my parents divorced, to go back to school and become a nurse in her 40s. And it was about that time in her 40s, and I was in my late teens, early 20s, that I was really starting to discover your work. And she and I used to have these wonderful conversations. And what I got most from your work is that the body is not this thing that's off doing whatever haphazardly happens, that we truly direct the wholeness and the healing of our bodies in many ways. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, what you can't separate the mind and the body. See, what the mind contemplates, the body assumes is true.
Yes.
I would just what you said about your mother. I mean, she gets a divorce. She then started a new life. Think of the message her body got when she's starting a new life and a new career, instead of, oh, look what happened to me, and sits in the living room depressed and crying all the time. Okay? But instead, she stepped forward, and her body got a message. Oh, you're going to school? You're going to be a nurse? Good. Okay, we'll try to keep you healthy and, you know, get everything working. Monday morning, we have more heart attacks, strokes, suicides, and illnesses.
Say that one more time. Did you say there on Monday mornings we have more heart attacks? Say it again.
Strokes, suicides, and illnesses.
All on Monday mornings. Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, why? I don't want to go to work. The traffic sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, your body does you a favor. Say, if I have a heart attack, I don't have to go to work. You know, or if I'm dead, I'm perfect again.
Right.
I don't have to do anything anymore. So your body doesn't see the illness as the wrong thing. In a sense, it's doing you a favor. I mean, for the wrong reasons. But what we see now, and I mean this in scientific way, because I was considered such a nut years ago, and blaming my patients, you see, because I'd say, what's happened last year or two in your life? And doctors would say to me, what are you blaming them for?
Mm.
I said, I'm not blaming them. I'm asking them why they could be vulnerable now.
Mm.
You see, because poets will write, childless women get it, men when they retire, it's as if there had to be an outlet for their foiled creative fire.
Mm.
That's about cancer by W.H. Auden. Now, where's he coming up with that? It's his observation of life. You know, he's seen things happen. And we know women live longer than men with the same cancers. And it ain't about their hormones. It's about their relationships. Because men sitting in my office have said, there's no point in living. I can't work anymore. And their wife and children are sitting right next to them.
Wow.
You see? So again, it's giving your body that live message. And when it really becomes an authentic message, you know, like a rebirth, you learn you have a few months to live and you quit your job, you move, you do all kinds of wonderful things. And a few months later, you notice, I'm not dead. You know? I know people who have spent their entire fortunes to have a wonderful few months before they die. And then at the end of 2 months, they're out of money and feeling wonderful. I want to sue their doctor. You know, and I always say, I don't make up these stories.
Right.
They happen.
You told a wonderful one in, I think it was Love, Medicine, and Miracles, about a person who always wanted to take up the violin, who had 6 months to live, if I recall.
Yeah, that was a lawyer.
Yeah.
He grew up, you know, with parents, you see, who imposed a life on him.
Hmm.
They took his life. No, we don't want you a violinist. We want to be proud of our son, the lawyer. He learned he had a few months to live, closed his office, got a job in an orchestra eventually, and he's not dead. I have letters that end with, you know, all the things people did because they agreed with the doctor. I mean, sometimes they were feeling so bad, they weren't arguing with the doctor.
Right.
But they went home to enjoy themselves, from getting a dog to all kinds of things. And the letter ends with, I didn't die, now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. Help, where do I go from here? That was a woman asking me for advice. I told her, take a nap. I mean, you know, but it's again, and this, you know, I always say, I'm not trying to make people immortal, but I'm trying to get them to live up to their potential. See, Solzhenitsyn used a wonderful term that fit right in with my experience in his book, Cancer Ward. See, you get well when you're not supposed to. Doctors will say things like, oh, you had a spontaneous remission, or you had a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
They don't stop and say, excuse me, I thought you were going to die and you didn't. You have anything to tell me that I could pass on to other patients? They don't ask. And
right.
I know people who should be dead who have said to their doctor, would you like to know what I did? No.
Wow.
I mean, I can't believe that. So I began to learn from my patients, you know, because when I started going out lecturing, and by the way, the name of the group is Exceptional Cancer Patients. I thought it was interesting. You put the word care, but it was exceptional.
Oh, well, thank you for, yes, I knew that. Thank you.
But,
okay.
So when we started doing that, and I started going out lecturing,
yes.
I would see people in the audience that I thought were dead. I mean, people, you know, from our office, patients I knew who hadn't showed up again, and you assume, well, they're dead. And I would go down into the audience after I'd talk and say, hey, what happened? Why didn't you come back? And most of them would say, well, what's the point of coming back when doctors tell you, you know, there's no hope, so why go for a checkup? But they always had a story about why they didn't die related to their life.
Let me ask you a question then. If we
let me put it in symbolic
please,
form.
Go ahead.
One moment.
Yeah.
In Solzhenitsyn's book, he uses the term self-induced healing.
Wow.
Okay?
Yeah.
And one of the men is reading a medical book and comes up with that term. And that really jumped off the page at me. And then the symbol that flutters out of the book is a rainbow-colored butterfly.
Hmm.
Now, see, the butterfly is transformation.
Mm-hmm.
The rainbow is order, because literally every color has meaning, an emotional meaning. So you put your life in order through a transformation. In other words, create a new life, and self-induced healing can occur, you see. And I thought that was incredible that an author, again, comes up with this term, because he had cancer. So, I mean, he's lived it. You know, it's in his unconscious. But for him to come up with that terminology, which is totally non-medical,
right,
meant a lot to me.
You say that all of the people who came and spoke with you had a story as to reason they did not die. Do you feel that we can, in some ways, short-circuit some of the ill health that we experience by beginning to focus on a story to live? In other words, if we have more of a passion and more of a purpose, does that help us ameliorate illness?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you see this from people. Well, I often read it. An article written by a physician and put in a medical journal years ago, because he was thrown into a concentration camp with his whole community.
Hmm.
He had no way of treating anybody. He expected all these people to die. You know, diabetics, heart disease, all kinds of things. And he just thought, this is going to be tragic. And then he suddenly noticed they weren't dying. And what he wrote about was the fact that if they couldn't work, he said they were either starved or got a bullet through the head. And if they were in the infirmary, nobody, you know, they were starved there, because if they were too sick to work, there was no point of feeding them.
Right.
And he said the mind chose another path. You know, it knew that illness was a danger, so it chose another path. And he had to write about it because, again, it impressed the hell out of him to see these people through their will and desire survive. And, you know, as they say, when you hear men say there's no point in living, the chemistry. See, what we're talking about, it's not just thoughts and feelings. They are chemistry. In other words, if you study lonely people, you'll find that they're the genes that affect immune function are suppressed.
Wow.
These days. So again, they're less likely to survive. And let me give you a simple study that was done by a graduate student. He took two actors, male and a female. He gave them a comedy, and they read the script, and he drew their blood while they were performing. And in the comedy, immune function went up and stress hormone levels went down in their blood. When he gave them a tragedy, the man murdered the woman's husband, and they meet. The opposite happened. Their immune function went down, stress hormone levels went up. When I heard this from his professor, it really impressed the hell out of me because I thought, this, you know, means nothing to them. Just reading words of a script.
Right.
And it's affecting them. So think about what happens when you lose a loved one, say, or your job, or get a divorce, or, you know, something happens to one of your children. And even, you know, when I talk about that, people, after a heart attack, study from Australia, you go home to a house with a dog. A year later, 5% of the people died if there was a dog in the house. If there was no dog in the house, 26% of the people died.
Wow, five times more likely if you don't have a dog.
Say, well, what is the dog doing? Yes, there's exercise, too, when you have a dog and take it for a
walk.
But it had to do, again, with relationship. When you pet a dog, your bonding hormones, oxytocin, serotonin, the same that occur in a woman after delivering a child, they rise, you see. And so, again, you have more relationships, feel good about life, and it affects your survival.
So does a more spiritual approach to living, in other words, beginning to see ourselves more connected with others, which then builds that connection, cause us, in your opinion, to feel healthier?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. There are people I also know who have left their troubles to God and had cancer disappear. The peace that came with what they did. And I always remember one lady in the office. She came in, because people knew I wasn't a normal doctor. She said, I have cancer. God is going to heal me. I want you to write up my case. I said, ma'am, why don't you let me remove your tumor and let God keep you well? And she got so angry at me that I didn't have the faith she had. She just was furious, turned, walked out of the office. About 5 or 6 years later, I'm in New York giving a lecture, and a woman comes up afterwards and says, hey, remember me? I said, I remember your face, but I don't remember, you know, the circumstances. And she told me she was that lady. Because I said to her, it's hard to be a saint, you know, and I worry about people say, I'll leave my troubles to God, because, you know, when the car won't start, the roof leaks, you know, the toilet doesn't work, you say, where's God?
Right.
But, she said, that's me. And I just gave her a big hug and said, it's so nice to meet a saint. You know, but she's not the only one. There was another in our office, a woman who went home to die, but came back a month or two later. You know, she was given an appointment just to keep track and try to keep her comfortable and all.
Right.
Went home to die, but came back a few months later. And my partner yells, hey, Bernie, come in here. You're interested in this stuff, because he was a and she had a large abdominal tumor, and he said, it's gone. I can't feel it anymore. And I said to her, tell them what you did, because they were all puzzled. She said, ah, you know. Those are her exact words. I went home, and I left my troubles to God. And that is something I work on, and again, it is scientific in this sense that this is my mantra now, which I would suggest to everybody out there. Because in a study, a friend named Mark Mincola has written a book called Total Health. He's a therapist. And he was pointing out that there are studies where people, because one of these was a Zen story. The guy comes to his Zen leader and says, what should I do? I'm feeling terrible. Say, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. And the guy comes back a few months later and says, I still feel lousy. What should I do? say, thank you for everything. I have no complaint whatsoever. And the guy eventually gets it. But Minkola was working with a study is, I am happy, I am healthy, I love my life. And people repeated that for something like 12 minutes, you know, throughout the day, for several months. And the percentage who were improved psychologically and physically was incredible. And so my mantra now is combining what the Zen master said and Minkola. I start all through the day, I say, thank you for everything. I am happy. I am healthy. I love my life. I also put in, I love my wife and family. I have no complaint whatsoever. And the things that have been happening to me are really amazing because, yes, it changes the way you think. When I walk the dog now in the morning, I stop and I say, hey, you haven't had any bad thoughts all morning. So it's like, hey, what am I going to do all day? But it really has made a difference. I just keep repeating it, and then more coincidences happen. You know, it's like the people you meet, and you just seem to be in the right place at the right time. And another, this is one of my craziness. I look for pennies. I always say it's a sign from God, because it's not of any great monetary value.
Right, you know, right.
But it's a sign. Liberty in God we trust, and Abe Lincoln, who is there to remind us that we're mortal, you know, and you never see him smiling on a penny. But, you know, for us to appreciate that we're here for a limited time and then enjoy the time. And I found a penny this morning walking the dogs, and these are not unusual places, but whenever I do, it's like, okay, thank you, God. You know, I know I'm on the right path, and I'll keep doing this. And even when loved ones die, I tell their survivors to look for signs from them. Because consciousness is not local. That's another thing.
I love that. Would you say that again? Consciousness is not local.
Non-local.
Non-local. We think it is. We think that it is our consciousness.
No. But right. Your body... Well, what I've learned is, let me start with this. Okay. Why do we sleep, say? And we're learning that sleep is a time when the brain is nourished and more waste products are taken out. It's like flushed. But I realize it's also the psychological waste that's dealt with then. The conscious mind is quiet. Your body can speak to you, and I mean that literally in symbols, telling you have cancer or don't or different problems. So pay attention. If a dream tells you to get something checked up on, go and do it. And if the doctor says, oh, that's crazy, don't worry, go to another doctor. If it really has told you you have a problem, make sure they really pursue it because, you know, I know people who have died because of, don't worry, you're too young to have that,
right.
You know, from doctors. And then a few years later, they learn the doctor was wrong.
And so these revelations are an example of this non-localized consciousness, that there's this higher consciousness that could come and speak to you and or your doctor.
Me is to meet an animal intuitive. She's not the only one I met, but she's the one who started, Amelia Kincaid. I was speaking for the ASPCA at an UNKILL conference in California. Met her in the elevator. You know, we started chatting, and she said, I'm an animal intuitive. And I thought, that's insane. You know, I mean, you talk to animals. I mean, maybe you can fool people, but I can't believe that. See, but I've also learned from that and other things, live by your experience, not your beliefs. Because doctors did that to me, too. I can't accept what you're saying, even though I was telling them the truth. So if something happens, you don't have to explain it. Just know it's part of creation. It happens. But anyway, a few months after that, one of our cats disappeared in a wooded area where we live. And in a few weeks, it's gone. I figured it's dead. But I thought, hey, I'll ask Amelia. So I sent her an email, and she's in Los Angeles, and I am in Connecticut. And I said, Amelia, tell me if the cat's alive, where it is. And one evening, I got an email from her saying, the cat's alive, I can see the moon through its eyes. And she went on to describe people, pets, the house. Such detail was absolutely incredible. And the next morning, I went out and just kept screaming the cat's name. Because what I didn't understand is she said the cat is under the house. That made no sense to me.
Okay.
You know, how do you get under a house? But the cat was under a stairway that came off the side of the house. And I heard it cry out after I screamed its name for about 5 or 10 minutes with all the other pets looking at me like I was insane. But she was under there protecting herself. You know, like put herself in a cage.
Yeah.
Had survived a few weeks outside by doing that, and then we got her back in the house. And Amelia has done it more than once for me. I mean, she described our basement where a cat was hiding from me. And, you know, when I say she described the basement, boxes, bags, junk, you know, things all over the place. She said, maybe the cat's in the garage. But when she described it, you know, to her, it looked like a garage.
Right.
To me, it was my basement. I went, and that's where the cat was. But again, the thing that she taught me, and that is a common theme, is you have to quiet your mind. See, I use the still pond because it appears in many myths and stories where you see your true reflection. You know, the ugly duckling is a swan.
Right.
In the still pond. The tiger brought up by goats. Oh, I'm a tiger.
Right.
When he looks in the... And when you quiet your mind, you can get into the animal's head or other heads and places around the world. And I know it's true now because I have been able to do that, because I always hear Amelia saying to me, Bernie, calm down, quiet your mind. And then amazing things happen.
It's interesting as you say this and you talk about pennies. For me, one of the things that's a great revelation for me is bald eagles. And I haven't seen that many, but just as we were speaking, I now live on a lake in Missouri, and one just came and did a lazy circle right outside my window. And to me, that just, again, shows that interconnectedness. And Native Americans knew this, Bernie. Native Americans could understand and sense and feel the energy of the animals. Exactly. They were quiet. I think we are so distracted these days.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what most people choose, is numbing or distracting themselves. And let me add this. You know, you said the bald eagle. I shaved my head in the 1970s when hairstyles in men were down to their shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it because I just had to do it. I mean, it was this inner message, so to speak. And I finally convinced the barber, because he was afraid our sons would murder him if, you know, he did it, because I was embarrassing enough as a father to shave the head. But you see, I didn't know why I was doing it. I began to learn as I pursued my course in life that it was what needed to be uncovered. Because even in a painting I did of myself, a portrait, I painted myself with a cap and mask and gown on as if I were in the operating room. I'm all covered up. And what I realized was that you have to know what you need to uncover. And one day when I was reading some of Jung's work, he started to describe a story in which the hero's head is shaved by people who, you know, grab him. And then he went on to say the shaved head is similar to what monks do. It is uncovering their spirituality.
Hmm.
And when I read that, it was like, thank you, Carl Jung. I began to call myself a Jungian surgeon. Because, I mean, that was what I needed to uncover. Not my skin of my head, but my spirituality. And recently, it was fascinating. My most recent book is called The Art of Healing. And there were 70 drawings in it and a lot of words from me to, you know, to discuss all these things I continue to learn. But it was up for a book award. And I got an email about it saying we selected your book, you know, to participate in an award contest. And I thought, oh, that's nice. Thank you. And I looked on the medical and health, you know, and the book wasn't listed. So scrolling down through all the books that they've picked in different topics, and where do you think it was? In spirituality.
Wow.
That blew my mind. I thought, here I am, a doctor, writing about health, and people are interpreting it as a spiritual book, but I could see that it's really happened, you know.
Sure.
If they're interpreting it that way, the change is truly happening within me, and I'm very happy to say that that is happening.
It's reflecting in your work. Watkins Review named you one of the top 20 spiritually influential living people on the planet. Congratulations.
Yeah, that blew my mind, too, but it's such a reward to have those kinds of things happen, to know that you're helping people.
See, well,
that's what my life has been about.
Yeah.
Let me say this, because this is another big issue, especially in medicine.
Yeah.
If you write in your application, "I'm fascinated by the human body," as a lot of students do, think what happens when you become a doctor. People show up. and there are so many famous paintings of doctors sitting with sick people, and the doctors are thinking, you know, they're chasing their hand kind of thing. They're not touching the patient, not embracing the child.
Mm.
They're sitting there thinking. And I cared about people. That's what got me into trouble, because it hurts to be a doctor.
Yeah.
I did a lot of children's surgery. And you really, the spiritual questions come up. See, why didn't God make a perfect world? And I like asking people these three. How would you introduce yourself to God? If you could be God for a day, why would you want to be God?
Mm-hmm.
What would you do if you were God for a day?
Mm-hmm.
And why didn't God make a perfect world? And believe me, these are part of the things I bring up in workshops, you know, for people to understand the nature of life and themselves.
And the interconnectivity and interrelativity of everything, which is basically spirit.
Right.
What do you see as the, do you see a further integration between spirituality and medicine in the coming decades?
I think so. I mean, it's a slow process. It drives me nuts. Because it took me 50 years to get an answer from the dean of my medical school when I said, "You made me a wonderful technician, but you didn't teach me how to take care of myself or my patients." And I kept the letter in the computer eventually and just kept resending it every time they'd get a new dean. You know? And finally, there's one who's a woman, and I felt there's an option now, and she answered. But you see, again, medicine is so oriented, you know, and they send out like the newsletter about your college or medical school. It's always about all the research and the new building we're putting up and
right.
the money people have donated. And there ought to be something about the patients and how we're teaching medical students to take care of people, you know, and not see people as a disease. Because that's what really happens.
Yeah.
You know, I've talked about Kevorkian many, many times, even on programs with his attorney, because if he had been understood himself while in medical school, see, he would not have let death become his problem. He's, you know, the way I put it is, instead of killing people, he could have been organizing a hospice and running one.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I help a lot of people die. I don't have to kill them. I don't have to feel like I'm in charge and my power and I'm in, you know, control of death. I teach people that they are in control. See? I've helped people who are brain dead die by saying your family loves you. Your love will stay with them. If you need to go, it's okay. And this woman died in 15 minutes. And the lawyers were saying, you can't take her feeding tube out because that's murdering her. I said to the family, let me take care of this for you. And all I did was stand next to her bed, say that, because they were too fearful to tell her that. And 15 minutes later, she's gone. And they're at peace, and so is she. We really need a medical education, if you know what I mean, not a medical information, that you need to understand people and yourself. So the interaction becomes a healing interaction. Because again, when you talk about consciousness, patients are asked, did the doctor talk to you, answer your questions? Did you have a feeling that the doctor was compassionate? Those who said yes recovered faster from their illness than those who said no, the doctor didn't talk and didn't feel compassionate. And I see it when I go to our own doctors in their offices. You know, you can walk into an examining room with a white wall and the only decorations are telling you what can happen to your heart and your prostate and your breast, and, you know. Yeah, and then I'll go to other doctors where it's a beautiful room with a blue wall, outdoor scenes, you know, and you sit there for a few minutes and you feel better, and your blood pressure goes down. And we know, again, from studies of people in hospitals, if they could view nature through the window or paintings versus abstract paintings, you know, or looking at a brick wall, if they looked out their window, the people who had views of nature had less pain, recovered faster, etc. The music I played in the operating room. I mean, all these things affected the patient's recovery as well as the people who were working with me. Because things I was called a nut and an explosion hazard for, bringing in tape recorders and other things.
Mm-hmm.
Within a week, everybody stopped telling me I was a hazard because they all felt better. So that's what I learned. Tell stories. Because they don't get you into arguments, like talking about a study and the statistical validity.
Right.
And yeah, but you tell a story about a patient, and they can say, well, that's just an anecdote. Right. But at least we're not arguing with each other.
Right.
And then you perform things. And if they're effective, nobody denies that it's effective, and they begin to mimic you. And the next thing you know, what you were called screwball about would become hospital policy. I used to laugh because my patients would say to me, you know, it's so nice here, the way everybody's taking care of me and talking to me. And I asked them why they do these things. And they said, oh, it's hospital policy. Now, those were things that I introduced.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I know.
But
yeah.
I never got credit for it. I didn't care. But, you know, I used to laugh because things that I was told, this is nuts and you can't do that. Yeah, it became hospital policy.
Well, I was watching a show not long ago about nurses that were being paid to be in the operating room to do Reiki on patients while they were having operations done. And I thought, you know, if Bernie Siegel hadn't done his work, the whole door wouldn't have opened up for all these other forms of loving spiritual practices and de-deifying medicine, and at the same time calling forth the internal healing that we all have to work right. with the existing medical structure we have.
Yeah, well, look where Mehmet Oz is now, you know, on TV.
Yeah.
Doing all these things about health. He's a cardiac surgeon.
Mm-hmm.
He had healers in the room with him. He had an open mind. And one of them, I forgot her name, but she wrote a book about the experience she had with him. But she said that they couldn't get the transplanted heart start beating one day. And, you know, he kind of turned to her and said, can you help us? And she said she went, you know, into this patient's consciousness. And it turned out the heart that they were trying to get going had come from someone who died in an automobile accident. And that the message she was getting was, I don't want to be in another body and hurt other people again. And she sent the heart, you know, wow. a message to deal with that. And the next thing you know, boom, 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 it's beating. And you see, those are the things that if you have an open mind, make you a believer.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Because I had patients, too, who were retiring, developed cancer. When I told them they needed more treatment, this one landscaper that I wrote about said, now I'm going to go make the world beautiful, so when I die, I'll leave a beautiful world. He said, it's springtime. 6 years later, he was in the office, but I didn't think it was him. I said to the nurse, we have two people with the same name. This guy's dead. She said, open the door, and there sat John. I have a hernia from lifting boulders in the landscaper. He lived to over 90, you know, taking care of himself and his wife. His mm-hmm. wife died. He flipped his switch off, too. But to live to be 93, and I have proof, you know what I mean, path reports. So
right.
The doctor can't say to me, maybe he didn't have it, or, you know. I know he had cancer still in him, but to go to age 93 with it never showing up. Or women. I mean, again, I have 9 children. I can't die until they're all married and out of the house. This is a woman who lived for 20 more years. When her 9th kid left home, the cancer came back. See, that's the part I always say that blows my mind. How did she manage to keep it under control for 20 years?
Right.
It is amazing.
It wasn't that it all came on at the end.
What I also want to share with the women is,
yeah.
keep your power. You know, be your 10th child, if you know what I mean. Don't say, oh, I'm not a mother anymore, so what's the point of living? Yeah, be your own mother.
Oh, I love that. Life. Nurture yourself, fulfill your own dreams. Well, Bernie, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much. What a joy to speak with you and to know that I'm, in my opinion, talking to the person who was the epicenter of a lot of the wonderful changes that's happened in medicine. Bernie Siegel's web address again is www.berniesiegelmd. That's BERNIESIEGELMD.com.
And they can communicate with me through that too. They need to.
Wonderful. That would be great. Reach out and speak to Bernie, just as I did.
Yeah, there's a webinar. I mean, they can see the drawings I was talking about and other things, and lots of articles. I mean, we could go on talking forever, but
I
think even deceiving people into health, that when you learn how to communicate with people, your words become hypnotic too. You know, you're the authority figure. So doctors need to be trained how to talk to people. So, you know, it's not you'll be dead in 2 months or here are the complications associated with the treatment. I mean, let them know they could get better, you know, and not like a TV commercial. I can't believe those commercials, you know, where it can cure your headache, but it can destroy your
exactly.
heart.
Exactly. You know. Tear your liver out, yes.
Yeah, right.
But you won't have a headache or frown lines.
Right.
Bernie, this has been great. Thank you so much. God
Thank
bless you.
Well, you're feeling fine.
Up next in the Namaste Lounge, Stowe Daily Shockey and Karen Taylor Good, or as they are known, Stowe Good. Hang around.
What if you could get inside the heads of 50 of the happiest people alive? What if you could hear their stories, learn how they overcame life's challenges, and discover their secrets to happiness? This is Happy Stories by Will Bowen. In Happy Stories, you'll meet parents, business people and entrepreneurs, students, retirees and construction workers, school principals, stay-at-home moms, and more who have one thing in common. They have discovered how to be happy, regardless of what life throws their way. Happy people hang around with other happy people as a way of staying happy. Read Happy Stories, and it's like having 50 very happy people with you at all times. Happy Stories by Will Bowen, available in print, ebook, and audiobook, read by the author. Happy Stories from Grand Harbor Press. Read these happy stories now, and your life will become a happy story as well.
It feels like there's a chasm, a giant gaping hole between all those happy people and me and my wounded soul. You know it don't seem right. God, it's just not fair. To get from here to there.
And Karen and Stowe are here with me. Welcome to the Namaste Lounge.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, that is one of your songs, Here to There. And before we even get into Here to There, I want to know how the two of you managed to come back together after so many years. Tell us the story of how Stowe Good came to be.
Wow, it's such a God thing because this is Stowe.
I had been
diagnosed with cancer a few years ago, and I almost lost my life to it. And my journey through it taught me that I had not been doing what I was gifted to do, what I was born to do. So when I came out from this life-saving surgery, I had like a mantra. It was like, I want to write with someone who shares my point of view. And I just asked God, you know, who should I write with? And it was like a week later, Karen popped back into my life.
Wow. Now, but you had written together when before? How long ago was it that you had known each other?
Since the early 90s.
Wow. Okay.
So we hadn't seen each other in all those years.
And what was the catalyst? What brought the two of you together this time? Where did you run into each other?
Well, you want to tell, Karen?
Well, yeah, this is Karen. I was asked to open a show for the Judds, and I hadn't been around a lot of showbiz stuff in a while. And so anyway, I was there doing the sound check and was overcome by all of the showbiz egos in the room and just felt like, why am I here? And then the sound person told me that nobody was going to hear me anyway because they always talk through this event at the dinner. And I was so depressed, I just wanted to cry.
Hmm.
And then I turned around, and there was Stowe. And I just looked at her, and I told her, I need help. So she grabbed my hand, we went in the back room, said a prayer, and it turned out to be one of the most beautiful nights ever. And that's how we reconnected.
Wow.
Now,
since,
he was wonderful.
Since then, the two of you have been very prolific. Your website, if I recall, says you've written somewhere around 40 songs, but if I understand, it's over 50 now. Is that right, since the two of you have gotten back together?
That's correct, and they keep coming.
Well, the two of you are both successful songwriters in your own right. How does it feel to come and collaborate with someone like that? Speaking of egos, is there ever any struggles or challenges like that? Ooh, long pause. I love those.
No, because this is Karen. I didn't want to step on my partnering ride here.
I didn't either.
I want to say, I have co-written with, you know, hundreds of people over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a totally different experience. I feel like I know how Gilbert must have felt when he met Sullivan and how Lerner must have felt when he met Lowe. And, it's magic, and it's a setup. It's a universe setup. It's so beautiful and easy. It's easy. It is like butter.
Well, explain the term like butter, because that's on your website as well. It says that together the two of you were like butter. What is, help us understand what that means.
Well, I think there's a skit on Saturday Night Live where someone was doing it. It's just like butter. And it really just says how, you know, how something can be very easy. And I believe we stepped off the stage early on in our time together when we first started performing. And I said, wow, that was just like butter. And then, of course, we had to write a song about it.
So now you are not only singing and performing, but you're also doing a lot of speaking together. Now, as a speaker, I've worked with translators, but I've never attempted to work with another speaker. How is that, the two of you working together?
Oh, it's like butter. It's seamless. It's beautiful. We toss things back and forth. Stowe reads some gorgeous pages from her book. I read some pages from my book. And then we stick the songs in, and we've created some workshops that are very powerful and affirming. Mm-hmm. And and we just can't wait to work with Will Bowen, may I say.
Well, I think that would be a wonderful opportunity. I think we could have a lot of fun with that. Tell me the history behind Here to There, the song that we opened this segment with.
Yeah, this is Karen. I would like to speak to that. And I feel kind of guilty, Will, because in your complaint-free world, this is a song we wrote for a grief workshop. We were asked to do a grief workshop.
Again.
And I thought about the tendency, and I'm not sure how to handle the not complaining and yet not taking a spiritual bypass around our feelings,
mm-hmm.
which some of us in the New Thought world are guilty of doing. And I've done it before. So this song was kind of like saying, you know what? I want to acknowledge that right now, my life is very difficult, and it hurts, and basically it sucks. And I know people tell me I'm going to get over this and I will get from here where I am to there where it's going to be better, but I don't know how to get from here to there. And basically, this is the only song we have that's like that, that addresses that particular state of mind. And I must tell you, a lot of people find great comfort in knowing that they're not the only one struggling.
Sure. Well, and I hopefully, and I think that my listeners know that when I talk about not complaining, it's not about stuffing your feelings. And I do get this idea that sometimes we need to speak things. I was actually walking up the stairs this morning with my fiance, and I was lamenting aloud. And actually, I wouldn't consider it a complaint. A complaint would be me trying to convince her that what I'm saying is true and how terrible it is. But I just spoke something aloud as a way of letting myself hear it. And when I heard it, I went, well, that's just silly. And so not to diminish that sometimes things are serious and we need to really just talk them out and express our feelings. But in some cases too, it's just something we need to say and we need to hear ourselves. I tell you what, let's take a moment and listen to another one of your songs. And this is titled Back from the Future.
Ooh, there's a scary place. Ooh. Between your ears, behind your face. So beware. Don't go there. Worry, worry, what will be? Imagine the catastrophe.
I'm speaking with Stowe and Karen, and we're talking about their music, their muse, and their musings. Tell me the story behind Back from the Future, would you please?
You want to tell that, Karen? I think I will.
Yeah.
Okay. I suffer from, I have an illness, Will. I have a condition, and the condition I think is shared by lots of other people. You know, my husband is supposed to be home at 5 o'clock and it's 10 after and I haven't heard from him and he's not home and I start to make stuff up.
Okay.
And then every 5 minutes that goes on and I still don't know where he is, the stuff gets worse. And I start making stuff up and making up the worst possible scenarios. I travel into the future and make myself sick. And I know that this condition is shared with many others.
Stowe, I need to jump in. It's funny that you say that because I have an 8 foot by 4 foot dry erase board here in my office. And I write down ideas that I'm inspired to write down. And this morning, right before we spoke, I wrote, you can have a fight with your boss, an argument with your son, a disagreement with your spouse, and never have to leave the comfort and security of your own mind.
That's right.
Well, and that's exactly what you're saying. Okay, so
exactly.
So expand now on how all this, and I love the idea of Back from the Future. Say more about the song, please.
Well, Stowe, you talk now.
Well, I don't know. Karen kind of brought this up at one of our songwriting sessions one day, and I don't know, we just started kind of jamming on a little rock and roll thing. So this is like a rock and roll mantra to remind you to live in the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
This is all you've got.
Boy, it is such a pithy comment, isn't it? Be present. If you're present to the present, it's a present. And yet it's a constant struggle, isn't it?
It is.
Especially for those of us who are used to time traveling.
I once saw a cartoon of a man falling off of a building, and as he was passing each floor, people would say, how are you? And he'd say, so far, I'm okay. And the point was, the guy was really living in the present. He was just, present to what was going on.
That's lovely.
I would like to know, though, that and feel that I'm falling into an even greater future, and I think that's true. As long as we believe that.
And you are.
Well, thank you. You as well. I'm speaking with Stowe Daly Shockey and Karen Taylor Good. We're talking about their new collaborative efforts, Stowe Good. Let's hear another one of their songs. This is called How Adored You Are.
child of mine, my beloved one, darling daughter, special son, you have never been alone. In my heart, you're always home. I'm not sure you understand. I am your greatest fan. Do you know how adored you are? How your precious heart is honored here? Do you know that you are love and you're enough, just the way you are? Do you know how adored?
That is something that we always need to remember, is that we are indeed adored. Tell us about the song. How did this come to be, this song?
Well, this song, you want to take it, Karen?
I was just going to talk about how it came, and then I would love for you to, way. I just want to say that of the 50 songs we've written, this particular song felt very different the way it was sent. We just felt like we were taking dictation from a higher place, and we feel like the message came through us out to our audiences, and that's all I wanted to say. So then, take it, Stowe.
Oh, I totally am total agreement with you. It was one of those songs that I personally kind of cried through the writing of, because it is such a powerful message to, I know I've struggled all my life, you know, to feel truly adored, and I get it now. I get it. And we, you know, our intention with this song is that other people may feel it, and we see it. You know, as we go around the country and we sing this song, we see the tears of people that really feel it. So,
you know, it's
I would say it's like the foundation of our message.
Well, I don't think there could be any greater foundation. I think it's the one thing that everybody needs to know and to understand about themselves. What I think is interesting is that if a child is not loved, or it is not shown that they are adored, then they begin to adopt that as a basic belief about themselves. And as Ernest Holmes says, they then project that basic belief out into the world, and the world echoes back, "You're right, you're not loved, and here's proof." And therefore they do not believe it, and it gets echoed back, and they do not believe it, and it gets echoed back. And then they start putting all these compensating behaviors on top of it that make them... that imprison them until at some point, maybe in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 90s, you come along and remind them of the truth. I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
How adored you are.
It's a great honor to be able to present that song, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
I just feel so lucky, so blessed to be able to do it.
Well, it sounds to me like the two of you have caught a second wind in your careers, and you are the second wind for one another.
Absolutely. And Will, I want to tell you one thing, that the way we start our workshops often is to say to people, if you could spend time with a 115-year-old woman with all of her experience and knowledge, and she's a mother, and she nurtures you and holds you to her bosom, and she has so much to teach you, would you like that? And everybody shakes their head, yes, yes. And then we point to each other and say, well, here she is. Between the two of us, six names, 115 years between us.
Guess what? Anything you share in this workshop, this 115-year-old woman, she doesn't really have a very good memory.
Okay, so it's safe.
So it's safe.
Well, this has been wonderful. Thank you both very much. Stowe Daly Shockey and Karen Taylor Good, six names between the two of them and 115 years of love and experience. The website is stowegood.com, stowegood.com, correct?
Correct.
Correct. Karen and Stowe, thank you very much for sharing time with me in the Namaste Lounge.
Thank you so much, Will.
Namaste.
Namaste.
And oh, how you would love yourself, sweet child of mine, if only you could see yourself through. You would know how adored you are, how your precious heart is honored here. You would know that you are loved and you're enough, just the way you are. It's yours.
So often it seems that people lash out in their anger and their fear, and if they could just remember how adored they are, how precious they are, then they could draw a deep breath and not get so engaged in things. It's easy for us to forget, though. I want to thank my guest, Stowe Good, for being with me today, as well as Dr. Bernie Siegel. And I want to thank you for being with me especially. And remember, save the date, September 21st, 2056. That's the day that world peace starts. All you've got to do is believe it. September 21st, 2056. Thanks a lot. Look forward to seeing you next time. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
When everything is out, you got to take it in.